Welcome, everybody. This is the second week's office hours session for the early 2012 edition of Mises on Money and Banking, where we go through the theory of money and credit. And as always, let me just announce for these office hours sessions, the material on this is not mandatory. You don't need to listen to this stuff. It's just it's a service for those who want more. And if you're tuned in live here, go ahead and type your questions right into the chat box because there's not that many people that show up live for these. And also, we do have a few new people that might be in here, so let me just once again let you know, don't wait for me to finish a question. Just go ahead and post your question, and I'll paste my answers based on how many questions are pending. Okay, so Jan says, Jan, there's a 7 that's there. I don't know what that 7 refers to, but anyway, I'll keep going. A mainstream economist is telling me that it can be that one project can be profitable at a low interest rate, then unprofitable at a higher one, and then again profitable at an even higher interest rate. It has something to do with labor capital ratio and the Wick-Sell effect. That would be in contradiction with Bumbaverick. Have you heard about it, and where is the flaw? Yeah, what that's called is re-switching. And I have a whole article on it. So here, let me give it to you. So it's not, I hope you didn't tell the person, you're right, that would blow up a bobber, but that's impossible because it is possible. It's true, it does pose a problem for Bumbaverick. Whereas I did that one early on. Hang on. I'm just looking through my archives at Mises.org. I did that when I was in grad school. I think. Maybe it was in grad school. What the heck is that? Switching. I don't know. Apparently there's a search engine called Google. So Robert Murphy re-switching. Let's see what that does. Yeah. Okay, so for people who are hearing just the audio of this, if you go and look at, just go to Google and do Robert Murphy re-switching. The name of the article is The Re-Switching Question, but here, for those of you who are tuned in, I'll post it in the chat box. Okay, so for people who are curious, it's a real subtle thing, so I'm not going to get into it too deeply right here, but basic Austrian capital theory, which does have its roots in Menger, but really it was Bumbaverick who, plowed the field. I don't know what the agricultural metaphor I want to use is here. But it was developed primarily by Bumbaverick, And the idea is, in the Austrian conception, that there's so-called original factors of production, which are land, which is a term that includes all natural resources, so the gifts of nature and labor. And so in the Austrian view, what capital goods are not really like this separate thing that contributes to output, but rather that they're a way that you can use land and labor in a certain fashion, because all capital goods were created by huge. You look at a tractor, in one sense, that's like congealed land and labor from the past, right? In some applications, that's not a good way to think about it, but that's kind of where the Bumbaverick. And so the idea was that the interest rate is kind of like a signal on how patient society is, and so if they're willing to wait more and to defer consumption, that allows society to invest its land and labor in longer processes. And because in general the longer the process, the more physically productive it can be, that all seem to fit together and to make sense. So that so if society saves more, if it cuts back on current consumption, then that allows for output to grow over time. And the idea was goods. Justify why the capitalists earn an interest income, and the idea was, oh, because they defer consumption, so that's why. And so to understand why is that the case, it's all because if you invest in longer processes, it's, you know, the resources are more, the inputs are more physically productive. So that was the idea. So a problem with that approach is you can come up with example, views, flows of consensuses. Well, you know, Bavarck and other Austrians in this tradition said, oh, it's because when people save more, that pushes down the equilibrium interest rate, and so then it'll lower interest rate, longer term projects, so things where you the lower the interest ends up, it's something more that, you know, ties everything together and explains the big picture of why it's good when people save more, or not good, but why when people save more, there actually is more real income down the road out of which we can fund their interest returns, that kind of stuff. So anyway, the one problem with that story is that you can come up with numerical examples of two different investment projects. All right, so in other words, you just specify physically what the thing is. You say, you know, this project, a certain amount of labor goes in period one, where labor is quantified in terms of hours. So we're not talking about money. We're keeping it in terms of physical units or oil, let's say, some scarce natural resource, and so on. And you specify that, and then 10 periods later, apples start shooting out or whatever. Cherry pies, whatever. And then the same thing you do, and the point is then you go ahead and try to put market prices and do whatever, and then you can come up with examples where, so the idea is, you say, okay, one of these projects is more long-term than the other one. The actual term the Bavarck used was roundabout. Okay, so it gets tricky when it's, you know, if one project says you put in 10 labor hours up front and then wait 10 years, and another, in the other project you put in 2 labor hours up front and you wait 1 year, well, clearly the first one is longer term, more roundabout than the second one. There's no ambiguity. But it gets tricky. scheme with, but not all in one fell swoop. You know, the stuff like that, it gets really tricky. So the problem, though, is it's not just a matter of quantifying it, that even if you could come up with some formula to explain, okay, project one is clearly the longer term one, this issue of reswitching arises because once it'll, you know, if the interest rate is between 0 and 5%, then projects A but if people are impatient, they don't save as much, so interest rates are higher than 5%, then entrepreneurs channel resources into project B, because that is the more profitable one. Okay, but the problem is, you can come up with scenarios where I'm not done with the story. Then if the interest rate, though, is 10% or higher, it re-switches back to project A now being having a higher market value than project B. So that's kind of weird. If your story had been that the interest rate is like a gauge of the degree of impatience of the consumers and whether they want to consume sooner or later, and the interest rate then had the role of allocating capital towards the investment projects that were either, you know, focused in the narrow term or the longer term. Because if that's your story, then these hypothetical scenarios where the same two physical projects, one of them is profitable at a low and at a high rate of interest, and the other one's profitable at an intermediate range of interest rates, that's kind of weird, because the idea is one of the projects has to be more long-term than the other one. You know, we can argue about what criteria you'd use to define that, but once you define it, clearly, you know, they're either tied or one is better than the other one. It can't be that at one range of interest rates, project A is more long-term, but at another range of interest rates, project B is more long-term. It doesn't make any sense. We were trying to independently have these concepts of long-term production projects to then make sense of interest rates. Which project is long-term or not shouldn't itself depend on what the market rate of interest is, at least if you're trying to tell the Bob Bevirkian story. So that's the challenge, and it, like I say, it is true. You can come up with these numerical examples of that. So anyway, I explained it all more fully and then give what I think the Austrian should say as a response to that in the article that I mentioned. because the only person. Person. That I know, the only Austrian that I know that really has harped on this stuff is von Bauwerk. And I'm pretty sure what I'm saying is consistent. But it's hard where I agree with him, the stuff that. Survives them assessing and critiquing. Or not. Shouldn't the assets that. Either. That capital that four greater than the billionaire. Strive for is we're miserable. Sometimes you can't even. It's not even that we don't know who's really happier. It's that that question. Is almost meaningless for an economist. That's something that a psychologist or a psychiatrist, we have so we can. because one way to think about it is there's no way to relate that to action. It makes sense, and because when you say right now you value your house more than you value your kid, one way to know that is if somehow you had to choose right now, you had to give up one, which would you give up? And the person says, oh, I'd give up the house and keep my kid, then okay, you value but what I'm saying, you can't really say, do you value your house now? More today than you did like. Last week. Look in my archives because I wrote about this somewhat recently. So while I'm looking this up, let me just give some general remarks. This is a very subtle issue. Okay, hang on, just bear with me one more second. So the stuff I'm talking about here, this is not controversial, right? I mean, Joe Salerno or Jeff Herman or Guido Hulsman, if they heard me telling this stuff, I'm pretty sure they would have no problem with it. And they said, yeah, that's what we think too. I'm just saying this is a really subtle point and an important point that I don't think we stress enough, because we, you know, keep beating the table over Austrians are subjective value theorists and it's all about your mind and da-da-da-da-da. And I think sometimes we don't really hammer home how it's kind of across individuals, and yet you take care of one person's preferences with another, and yet you put them all together, give them some dollar bills, and all but on the other hand, we get mad that, geez, these other economists somebody might be confused. It seems that those things kind of predict each other. Maybe it was the second one, but the example that Mises had, where the one person values apples and the other person values pears or something like that, I forget the fruits that were involved, but the exchange involved three of one fruit and two of the other. So I might be changing the I mean, Bill, you know, that but we can also now say, what about the market? For the market price of two bananas, and then you would be allowed to divide through. If you want, because market price is an objective thing. So there, you know, you say, okay, so objective valuations are ordinal. You can't do mathematical operations on that. It doesn't make any sense. So what is the market price is like? It takes Alan and Bill. Subjective values and it somehow combines them? Well, not mathematically, or not that we know, but we choose as economists praxeologically to interpret what happened to explain the objective phenomenon of one guy handing over three apples and the other guy handing over two bananas, and for the law to recognize that the property titles went with. We interpret that as saying, oh, they're doing. The objective market price, that's, yeah, I would probably say that. It's in the way I just described, so I don't know how you want to talk about that. So, part of what's weird here. If the thing that we're using to gauge market price, or the thing in which we express market price is the monetary unit, so let's say ounces of gold, if prices go up in terms of gold, we actually, you can say wealth went up in terms of But ultimately, 10 times as much physical do, the wealth would go up. But, you know, somebody could understandably say, yeah, but people aren't. Really. Living in apartments as much, and they want to go live in a house, and they want to just live out in nature or something, or you know, if a new product gets developed, you know, so that consumer bundle that would exist. In 1940, didn't have computers in it, and then 60 years later, presumably, consumers are a really important feature of the typical household's standard of living, right? So my point is, with all this stuff, you're never going to really get to we want to put a measuring rod against the person's psychic happiness, because that's really what's important, because you can't measure someone's psychic happiness, or at least not as an economist, you can't. So that's all of these things are never going to give you what you want. On exactly if what not only are they people might be influenced by what the legal system says. And so for our purposes as economists, that might be relevant, but not because we're blindly adopting the definitions of the legal system, but just because the legal system might affect how individuals act. We as economists care about how individuals act. All right, so one thing he said in particular that's kind of pithy and that I should certainly elaborate on right now is he said the legal system treats money as a universal medium of payment, whereas the economist treats money as a universal medium of exchange. So that's kind of an interesting dichotomy. What the heck is he talking about? So the medium of exchange, let's just review that. That means, you know, a medium of exchange means when you exchange something, you accept, you give up the thing you're getting rid of, and you accept something in return that you plan on yourself trading away in the future. So there's two different exchanges going on. So like, let's say you have your labor and you ultimately want to get a hamburger for it. Under direct exchange, you would have to find somebody who had a hamburger and wanted your labor services. And that's going to be a very restricted set of opportunities for you. So under indirect exchange, of course, you just need to find somebody out there who wants your labor services and then gives you something that is very liquid, that's very marketable, that the community in general desires. And then you go and find the person that has the thing that you're the hamburger, and you trade it for that. Okay, so there, the thing you did that with is a medium of exchange, and if everybody in the community thinks the same way about that particular commodity, then that thing is a universally accepted medium of exchange. That's what money is for the economist. Okay. But for the legal system, money is a universal means of payment. And what Mises means by that is that it's not an exchange. In the legal system, there's cases where the judge has to figure out that, you know, party A owes something to party B. And so the point is that gets quantified in terms of money. So if Bill goes up and breaks Alan's arm, the judge is gonna say, okay, Bill, you're guilty of that, and maybe it was an accident, you know, it's not a crime, but it's a civil case. So yeah, you broke his arm. So the remedy is what? You can't say undo the breaking of his arm. That you can't. He broke it. That's done. But what you can do is you say, okay, you owe him some money. And then, it's the function of the legal code to figure out principles so the judge can come up with a number to assign. So there was no exchange going on there. It wasn't that Bill said to Alan, hey, I would really like to break your arm. How about I do it for $200? Is that fair? And then Alan says, yeah, if you give me $200, you can break my arm. And then they do that. That's not what happened there. Bill broke his arm. And he shouldn't, you know, the violation of property rights, and now the judge comes along to remedy the situation and says, okay, you got to make a payment. So the point is, you know, the payment is, the judge isn't going to say you owe him 16 barrels of trout or you owe him 13 necklaces. He's going to quantify and say you owe him this much money. So there, but sorry, the point is, he actually wouldn't say money. I just screwed up that point. He would, in the United States, he would say you owe him $200 or whatever, $2,000. And in Europe, he'd say he owes you 1,600 euros. Or if it were a community that used gold as the money, was a Rothbardian paradise, he would say you owe him a half an ounce of gold. Okay, so the point is that the unit that they would pick to express the damages would itself be quoted in terms of the money commodity. Another thing too is if you have a breach of contract. So let's say there was an intertemporal exchange and the one party didn't come through on it. So I'm trying to think of, it's kind of tricky to even come up with these because most contracts would even be denominated in terms of money. But if I can't think of a great example, but let's say two comedians had an agreement, or two talk show hosts had an agreement that, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Jon Stewart have an agreement and they signed a contract and everything, and Bill O'Reilly says, okay, John, when I, you know, when my book comes out, I want you to have me on your show and I'm going to talk about my book. So, you know, because I want to promote it. And then when you have your book come out, you come on my show and I'll let you talk about your book so you can boost your sales. And they have a contract and everything. And then, you know, O'Reilly's book comes out first. Jon Stewart has him on The Daily Show, makes fun of him, rips on Fox News, but O'Reilly gets his name out there and maybe sells some more books. And then Jon Stewart comes out with his book, but Bill O'Reilly doesn't have him on the show. So here, if you assume that's a legally binding contract, and I realized as I started walking down this example, I think Murray Rothbard and Stephen Kinsella would say that's not an enforceable contract, but forgive me for that one. I could have come up with a better example. It's the point is the judge can't tell Jon Stewart you have to go on the show. You know, but he might say you owe a bunch of money. Or let's forget the indentured servitude example. The reason, incidentally, in case you guys are wondering, the reason I'm having trouble coming with an example is I'm trying to make one where the terms didn't involve money, but then the judge imposes it in terms of money. That's why I'm not doing something real straightforward, because most contracts would involve money. Okay, how about this? So there's a contract that people enter into, and the farmer has a bunch of grapes, and he says to the guy who makes wine, here, I'll give you these grapes, and then when you make the bottles of wine and store them or whatever, then 10 years from now, you give me 10% of the bottles of wine, you know, the aged bottles of wine, and that's what you're going to deliver to me, and I'll give you all the grapes right now. And the guy says, okay, and they sign a contract, blah, blah, blah. Now 10 years goes down the road, and the guy who makes the wine has a big party, and you know, his daughter's getting married, and he, you know, he screws up, he gets mixed up, and all his guests drink all the wine, and he's got nothing. So now the guy takes him to court and says, what the heck? And so the judge is not going to say to the guy, to the defendant, you have to go get a bunch of bottles of wine somehow and get, you know what I mean? He's just going to say you owe this guy, and he's going to quote it in terms of the price that the wine would have fetched on the market. So there, the point again is money for the legal system is the means by which you settle up with somebody else. It's the means of payment, or the medium of payment. It's, you know, for generic obligations. Okay, so I'm hoping, who asked that, Jan? So Jan, I'm hoping that sheds a little bit of light on it. I mean, Mises knows way more about this than I do. I mean, because Mises just has read everything, at least as of when he wrote that book. So if I'm hoping I'm at least getting you to see what the issue is, and then when you read through, you can see some of Mises' treatment and you know, look at his footnotes and everything, and he might give you better examples than what I'm doing. But that's the issue. Okay, let's see. Jan says, some people claim that a monopoly maximizes profit at a price higher than marginal costs, and therefore price regulation is needed. Where is the flaw? Well, there's a a ton of stuff that's wrong with that, Jan. I mean, I think you were in the Rothbard class, right? So I wouldn't be saying much beyond what Rothbard says in that big chapter on monopoly theory. Oh, you weren't? Okay. Well, Rothbard and Man, Economy, and State has a whole chapter devoted to, I think it's chapter 15, but I'm not sure about that, devoted to monopoly theory. So just very quickly, it's So for people who don't know, the standard mainstream view that Jan's alluding to here says, in a price-taking equilibrium or a competitive equilibrium, price equals marginal cost, and that's socially optimal for various reasons. Whereas the monopolist restricts output below the level that a competitive market would produce, and so now price is higher than marginal cost, so that means that society would be better off if we increased output. Because since price is higher than marginal cost, that means the benefits that the consumers get from one more unit, meaning the amount they would be willing to pay for one more unit, is higher than what the producers would need to be paid to compensate them, to make them willing to produce one more unit. And so it looks like there's gains from trade that aren't being exploited. Like, how come society is not using resources to produce those extra units on the margin? Because the consumers would be willing to pay more for them than the producers would need to be paid to make it worth their time to do it, or worth their while to do it. So it looks like there's gains from trade that aren't being seized, and so it's Pareto suboptimal. That's, using mainstream language here. So there's lots of problems with that, and Rothbard goes through them. One thing is, it's a very static conception. It assumes that that the producers all know how to make the product, and that there is this perfectly competitive benchmark against which to contrast the monopoly outcome. But Rothbard says, in the real world, there is no such thing. We have the market price, and it doesn't make sense to contrast that with some hypothetical competitive price. So I think the easiest way to show that is, if some entrepreneur comes up with a new product and starts selling it, and it's something that nobody else had ever thought of, and in the beginning he's the only person in the industry, then what would it mean to say, oh, is that price a monopoly price or a competitive price? Because if you say, if by competitive price you mean, well, what if everybody, what if there were 1,000 other entrepreneurs that had all the factories and everything and knew how to crank out this product and knew the blueprints and the design of it and everything and had thought of the concept and had done all the, all the work and whatever. And so now if there were 1,000 other entrepreneurs who were perfectly equipped to crank this product out just like this innovator was, and then we looked at what would the equilibrium in the market be under those conditions, and would society be better off in that situation or with this one guy dominating the industry, that's a nonsense question, right? It's kind of like saying, would society be better off if there were 1,000 Bill Gates versus the one? Well, yeah, just like the NBA would be cooler if there were 1,000 Michael Jordans, and Michael Jordan wouldn't have been able to get such a high salary if it were just him compared to if there were 1,000 of them, but there weren't 1,000 of them. So what kind of comparison is that? The proper comparison, if you're looking, as long as there's a free market with free entry and there's no, government privileges, if you're looking at an industry where there's just one dominant player that, controls the market and has virtually all the market share, that's not an indication that, oh, man, that guy must be restricting output. No, the correct thing to say is, holy cow, that guy is producing something that nobody else is. And so whatever the reason is, as long as he's not using force or the government's not doing it on his behalf, why would we get mad at that guy? Okay. Peter had a little comment about my John Stewart, Bill O'Reilly example and saying that there are ways to get around that. So there, just to not leave people hanging, the issue is, under certain conceptions of libertarian legal theory, you can't enslave somebody else. So the idea is, I'm like, as an actor, a movie studio might come up to me and say, okay, we want you to be the star in our film, but you know, this is a big thing, and if we start putting out commercials with you as being the star, then we start hiring other actors and actresses that we know would have good chemistry with you on camera, and then you back out 1 week before we're going to start shooting it, and we're going to go to Siberia. So, I mean, this is going to be a big deal. We're going to spend millions of dollars getting ready to do this. If you back out, we're going to be totally up a creek. So we want you to sign a contract saying if you back out and don't do the film for us, you know, then we can take you to court and you owe us a bunch of money. I think Rothbard would say, depending on how you phrase that contract, actually that could be unenforceable because it's almost like the person's selling ownership in his body. Or if it's an actress, she's selling ownership in her body, and Rothbard says, no, you can't have slavery. So there are ways around that, though, that the person might have to put up a performance bond, right? So the person could take, you know, if it's a rich movie star already, they could take some of their wealth and then post it somewhere, you know, give it to some third party who holds it as collateral, and then they could sign a contract saying, if I don't show up and shoot this movie like I say I'm going to, then, you know, you can get this property over here. So there, you know, there's no issue of the person owning the labor of the movie star. It's just they're saying, if I do something down the road, you give me this much money in terms of my payment, but if I don't do it, obviously you don't owe me any payment, and also I will give you this. And also, too, they probably, like, have the person, the movie studio, give them $1 up front, so there's an exchange of property, so it's not purely just this, like, conditional promises, but just, you know, saying, no, it's an exchange. We give you property now, and then down the road you're going to give us something, blah, blah, blah. And so if you fail to fulfill that down the road, you've clearly stolen from us. That's the idea. So anyway, Peter is saying he's apparently been emailing with Stephen Kinsella about this stuff, and it's more of an issue of the proper way to frame it in terms of standard libertarian theory, where contracts just talk about the exchange of property titles, and you can't sell yourself into slavery. That's the issue. So Hollywood would still survive in a Rothbardian paradise, or, you know, movie studios would still be able to protect themselves from fickle actors flaking out on them 2 weeks before production's supposed to start. It's just the way the contracts would be worded and what actually is happening might be a little bit different from the way the layperson right now would talk about it. Okay, well, we're out of time here, and Peter, at the last second here, is asking me about Bitcoin. I still am writing that up, Peter, so I hope that will be done soon. But I haven't answered it in the archives yet, so I will catch up on that too if I don't have the article done. All right, so everyone, thanks for tuning in, and I will see you all on Wednesday.